Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Hey, I'll be on stage at the Englert Theater in Iowa City tomorrow night to moderate a discussion with, among others, Tamara Keith of NPR, Chris Buskirk of American Greatness, and Melissa Ryan of Control-Alt-Right-Delete. We'll talk about the future of politics, the future of the Democratic and Republican parties from a left, right, and analytical perspective. Tomorrow evening, it's free admission at the Englert Theater in Iowa City if you would like to come. 7 p.m. is the start time for that event. The women's vote and the gender gap in voting have been the subject of intense analysis for decades now. My guest this hour is Kelly Winfrey of Iowa State University. She's author of the new book, Understanding How Women Vote, Gender Identity and Political Choices. Kelly is coordinator of research and outreach at the Kerry Chapman Katz Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University, also assistant professor at Iowa State at the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication. She joins us in our AIM studio today. Kelly, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
So tell us more specifically about the nature of the research you did for this book and what you were trying to shed more light on.
Well, it really starts with what you mentioned at the beginning of the segment, which was the gender gap in voting. You hear a lot of political pundits before every presidential election talk about the women's vote. And in 2008, I thought it was particularly interesting given Hillary Clinton's unsuccessful bid for the Democratic nomination and then Sarah Palin's appointment to or getting on the ticket with McCain for vice president. And I heard some pundits talking about whether or not Hillary Clinton voters would go vote for Sarah Palin because she was a woman. And I thought, well, that's silly. They couldn't be more different in terms of their views. And it made me wonder in what ways women were different from men and also what way women were different from each other. So when I went into this project, what I was looking at were those two questions: is how are women different from men? And what I found was that there are a lot of ways that women are different than men in terms of which party they support in greater numbers. Women are more likely to identify and vote for Democratic candidates. Women are more liberal than their male counterparts on a host of issues, from the role of government to social services, government regulation, foreign policy. And what I was also looking at was how women were different from each other, which gets to the title, the gender identity portion of that title of my book, is really looking at how a person, particularly a woman's beliefs about gender roles, influence what issues she finds important and what her issue or what her position on those issues would be.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's interesting because we have talked many times on this program, our Politics Day, for instance, about women's vote, about the gender gap in voting and what female candidates tend to stand for. But what go further into the psychological and sociological reasons that women do tend to vote more Democratic than Republican.
Well, there are a lot of reasons that, like you said, have to do with socialization in some way. Women are socialized to be more compassionate, to be more concerned about others, which in turn means they're going to be more likely to think about the needy, the poor, children, the elderly than men are. Women are also, through socialization and through their economic status, have been more likely to be recipients of government support programs like welfare or food stamps. Women are more likely to be minimum wage or part-time workers. So economic issues and minimum wage issues affect them differently. And so that then leads them to have positions that are more in line with the Democratic Party through their experience in the workforce or in the family.
Mm-hmm. In your book, I thought it was interesting, too, that you look at the key political differences among American women themselves, not but the subgroups. You break down women into subgroups. So talk a little bit about what subgroups you explored and found.
So kind of the first layer was to look at women who feel a strong connection to their gender group of women. So in other words, for some women, being a woman is a very central part to their identity, and they identify as a woman in regularity in terms of what if someone were to criticize the group of women, then they would take that personally. They feel that they are a typical woman. They tend to say we as opposed to they when talking about the group women. So a sense of connectedness with other women as a sense of we. And what that means politically is that women are going to think about how policies affect women as a whole. And they're going to, what I found in this book, also sometimes favor female candidates because they'll see women as part of their group and having some shared experiences. Mm-hmm. The second layer is to look at that piece of what people think about gender roles. So we have the what we would usually consider feminist or more egalitarian beliefs about men and women's gender roles, which you might see with candidates like Hillary Clinton. On the flip side, you see candidates or voters also that have more traditional gender role beliefs, so tend to believe more that women are better at caretaking and should be in charge of the home, that have maybe more pro-life positions, that might have more conservative positions when it comes to religion. And you might think of like Sarah Palin or Michelle Bachmann as examples of those women as candidates. And so those beliefs about gender roles and what women's places in society will also lead to different positions on issues. So take the issue of abortion, for example, extremely controversial issue. But when you think about women on either side of it, they're both connected to the issue because of their identity as women. One is looking at that from a perspective of rights over one's body, while the other is looking at it from the perspective of motherhood and protecting a child.
Mm-hmm. Are there, in these subgroups of women, sort of breakouts depending on the age? Does it matter? How much does it matter, depending on women who are younger or older?
It varies, but in general, there are more older women who are more traditional, but that doesn't mean there aren't also young women that are traditional. So it does skew a little bit older, but that's not something that's going to go away as, you know, the oldest generation goes away. So it's still something that there are a lot of women feel that way. So age matters, but isn't that important. Education is a factor that does matter. More educated women tend to have more egalitarian beliefs about gender roles. There are party differences, but all of those factors don't in and of themselves explain these beliefs. So there's something that's unique about gender roles and what that means for a woman and her identity that can't just be explained by education or by political party affiliation.
Mm-hmm. What do you see that lines up with your research or perhaps defies the norms in your research when you look at our congressional members who are female? Our new members, Abby Finkenauer in the 1st, Cindy Axne in the 3rd district, Joni Ernst, U.S. Senator Ernst.
Mm-hmm. I think that in terms of how they've campaigned and the issues they've talked about, they fall pretty nicely into the two categories that I lay out for women that are connected to their gender group. Joni Ernst is a good example of a more traditional, a woman with more traditional beliefs about family and gender roles. And, you know, she talked a lot about being a mother. That was a central part of her campaign. But also has
talked a lot about guns and going to a gun range.
Yeah.
How does that and castrating pigs?
Yeah.
So how does that fit in?
So, no, I think that's a good point. The gun question actually is an interesting point because women on the right have characterized guns as a family safety issue, as protecting your family. So, again, that can be tied back to those kind of gender norms. On the other hand, Abby Finkenauer and Cindy Axne campaigned on a much more feminist position. I wouldn't say, you know, that was the central part of their campaign was saying that they were feminists, but they did campaign on things like equal pay and increasing the minimum wage and guaranteeing health care and things like that that tend to be more liberal issues that appeal to that segment of women voters.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, what are your thoughts about the record number of women serving in the House of Representatives and how it's changing that body, its early days of the new session of Congress, in particular in this new Democratic majority, which is very diverse? There is a a group of outspoken progressive women that have seized sort of the center stage. Ilhan Omar, Minnesota, of Minnesota, of course, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who now more often goes by AOC from New York, and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan. Very outspoken women. Does that surprise you at all?
No. Okay. I think that first off, you know, they got this far, which is important, that we have a record number of women serving in Congress, though we're still a long ways from 50%. So I think it's important to take the victory, but also realize there's a lot of work to do. But these are women that in order to get to where they are, in some cases upsetting longtime Democratic representatives in a primary, these women had to be outspoken. And they do talk about things often from their social location, and that might be as women, but also as other parts of their identity in terms of ethnicity or religion are important to what they say. And so I think that brings something to the discussion that wasn't there before. And that's as research shows that as there's more women in legislative bodies, there is more collaboration, there's more bipartisan bills, women are more likely to work across the aisle to solve problems. And I think that's what we see with this group of young women is an effort to address problems and to actually get some work done. And I think that's probably overall good for the legislature, though it's really early and hard to say, you know, what will happen.
But I guess explore the stereotype that we have in politics and whether it's a myth that women lawmakers are inherently more civil, you've said more collaborative, cooperative, perhaps less power hungry, less personally ambitious than men. Is there any truth to that when we talk about, well, the representatives that I mentioned, the outspoken ones, the idea that women are perhaps a key to a kinder, smoother running Congress?
Well, research does support that women are more collaborative and they do sponsor more bills bipartisanly. So that is true in terms of the research that exists. Now, what I will say is that, you know, women up to this point in almost every, you know, state legislative body have been the minority and usually significantly the minority. So if women were 50% or more, would that change? I don't know. But we do know that at least to this point, that tends to be true. And I'd also say that because of the socialization we talked about earlier in terms of how women are taught to think about other people and taught to be compassionate, that women, you know, internalize that and do bring that to the legislative body as they make policies and as they try to work with others in the Congress or state legislative body.
Kelly Winfrey is my guest of Iowa State University. Her new book, Understanding How Women Vote, Gender Identity and Political Choices. Kelly, before we say goodbye, I'd like to ask you about some women in the news, perhaps a comment on the leadership of the New Zealand Prime Minister. It was last Wednesday, just 6 days after a man gunned down worshippers in two New Zealand mosques, killing 50, that the Prime Minister of New Zealand, I'm going to not get her first name right, Jacinda, is that, do you know? Jacinda Ardern?
I think that's right.
She's swiftly banned military-style semi-automatic weapons. She's 38, perhaps the youngest female world leader. What are your thoughts on her leadership, also considering her gender?
I think that she has shown strength and decisiveness while also showing a lot of compassion. I think she's handled this beautifully. She, I think, in a lot of ways demonstrates what a leader should do in a time of national crisis, which is to provide some, you know, counsel to the country and help them mourn at the same time address and solve a problem. And so I think she's really demonstrated that women can lead and lead very well in times of crisis.
Mm-hmm. In 2016, the last time we had a presidential election, Hillary Clinton spoke of shattering the glass ceiling by becoming the first female presidential candidate of a major party. Now there's a whole host of women vying for that 2020 Democratic nomination. Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren, Tulsi Gabbard. What are you watching in these women candidates in this caucus campaign season, Kelly?
Well, I think a couple things. One is I'm reading the news and watching the news and seeing how women are being covered. you know, Hillary Clinton received a lot more negative coverage than Bernie Sanders did in her primary campaign. And so I'm curious to see if women are being covered equally to men.
If we've moved on, if we've improved there.
Yeah. You know, and I would say it's not looking great so far.
Why? But, do you have an example or two?
Yeah, I think, you know, the big thing is that women are the question is always, are women likable? And it's not a question we ask very often of men. We often, you know, Kristen Gillibrand's announcement speech, one of the first questions was, are you likable enough? Is this what people need? Is somebody likable?
Mm.
Amy Klobuchar was talked about being Minnesota nice, but then it was, you know, maybe she's not that nice to her employees. And maybe is that a problem?
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not a question that, you know, I don't know.
I've heard Beto O'Rourke being talked about as charismatic. That's another way of saying likable.
Yeah,
or not, right?
And I'd argue that that likability can be an asset for men, but it's not required for men.
Okay.
You know, Trump, I don't think many people would argue he's likable, but he was electable. Bernie Sanders, people aren't really talking about whether or not he's likable. They're talking about his positions. And women have to first pass a likability test before they're even considered as a viable candidate. And so that's one of the areas that I think, you know, we need to watch is if we're going to focus on personality, then let's focus on everybody's personality.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather we think about and we focus on what issues they're talking about. So in terms of what the women candidates are doing, I'm really looking to see how they campaign. You know, we've had a very small number of women that have sought a major party nomination, 8 throughout history until now. So we're about doubling it in one election. And so we haven't been able to really see if women campaign differently from men when they run for president and how their campaigns are received. And now we have 6 women that we can look at to see what they're doing and what works for women and compare that to what the men are doing and what works for them.
Mm-hmm. Let's pivot back to women as voters. What advice would you have for any of these candidates, male or female, who are looking to engage and persuade women voters?
I think the key is to talk about issues that matter to women, but don't assume that all of those issues relate to their reproductive organs. you know, the economy matters to women, minimum wage matters to women, healthcare matters to women, and oftentimes affect women differently than men. So I think what's important for candidates in persuading is to talk about issues that are important to women in the way that they are important to women.
Mm. Okay, so I'm trying to picture maybe an example there. Are there perhaps examples of things in that? I mean, outright sexism, okay, that's
yeah.
a given. We don't do that. But are there ways that we might not suspect as being something that a woman would tend to reject as a plea for her vote?
Something that women would reject?
Yes, that might not be immediately obvious. I'm just trying to look for an example of what you just mentioned.
You know, I think that when you talk about military issues, for example, or national security issues, oftentimes those tend to be rather distant and not personalized. And so I think, you know, and from my research, they're not a high priority for women voters. So if you were going to talk about issues like that, you would need to talk about how it affects women's day-to-day lives, their lived experience, their families, and the people that they care about.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Back to this question you raised at the beginning about, Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin, and that they're two completely different political animals. But do any women, or to what degree do women vote based on gender? Or is that just a myth?
It's not a myth, but it's not true of all women. What my research shows and other research before has found is that if all else is equal, there are a good portion of women that will prefer a woman over a man. So, for example, in a hypothetical, you know, 2 hypothetical candidates with the exact same qualifications and issue positions, one's a man and one's a woman, women will be more likely to choose the woman. Mm-hmm. Those are hypothetical candidates, and no 2 candidates are actually equal. So, I would say that women do have women candidates can have an advantage among women voters, but they have to figure out how to talk to women voters as well.
Should one of these female candidates in the Democratic Party get the Democratic nomination for president, they would likely face, as far as we can tell at this point, Donald Trump.
advice specifically to facing Donald Trump in a general election, perhaps based on Hillary Clinton's experience?
I think, it's hard to use Hillary as an example since she lost. So you don't want to go too much to say to do what she did. But
she lost the Electoral College,
yes.
not the popular vote.
That is true, too.
I was just heading off a lot of emails that perhaps were heading my way.
Yeah. Now, I will say, as far as I know, the Electoral College will still be there in 2020.
Yes.
So we still have to deal with that. But Hillary Clinton, I think, did a very good job in the debates and kind of handling Donald Trump's outbursts and interruptions in terms of kind of staying firm in what she was saying, being assertive, but also staying calm. Women have to always negotiate that double bind. If they talk too loud or too assertive, they're not liked. If they don't speak up, then they're seen too weak. So
men on the other hand can flip out a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, women have a lot more, or men have a lot more flexibility in what traits they can demonstrate.
Mm, okay. Going forward, we have less than a minute. What questions do you have, perhaps for more research in the future? What's a big unanswered question you'd like to find the answer to?
I think the big question is, what do women have to do to win elections? and we're getting there looking back at 2018, but I'm really going to be focusing on what these women running for president are doing and how successful it is. We're planning to do some research at the state fair during the soapboxes and some events in Iowa to see how women are campaigning here and how Iowa voters are perceiving that, and hopefully be able to give some advice to people in the future.
Kelly Winfrey, thank you so much. Thanks. For sharing your research. we'll be back knocking on your door for more analysis. Kelly Winfrey of Iowa State University, her new book, Understanding How Women Vote, Gender Identity, and Political Choices. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can email us anytime, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.